Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something that can help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers, we reflect, we prepare, we think deeply about the challenging issues of our time, and we work through this philosophy in a way that's more possible here when we're not rushing to work or to get the kids to school, when we have the time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with our journals, and to prepare for what the future will bring.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit, FIT/dailystoic, and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. If you remember in The Obstacle is the Way, I tell the story of Tommy John. And Tommy John played 26 seasons in Major League Baseball. He was a pitcher. And I was sort of marveling at in that section on him on how long 26 seasons was. I think when he started, Kennedy was president. And when he ended, George H.W. Bush was president. He pitched against Mickey Mantle and Mark McGwire. So 26 seasons. You know, in a normal job, 26 years is a long time. They give you maybe a gold watch or something. I think my dad worked for the police department for 25 years. That's a long time. But in athletics, that's like an eternity. That's like several lifetimes. And my guest today, Manu Ginobili, of the San Antonio Spurs, was drafted by the Spurs. He was the 57th overall pick in the 1999 NBA draft, and he didn't end up actually playing for the Spurs until 2002. He played in Europe for a few more seasons, but he played 23 seasons in the NBA, which is incredible. I think the Spurs have consecutively made They made the playoffs his entire career, and I think they've now made it in both seasons that he has been retired. So it's an incredible run, an incredible dynasty. I mean, just to think about what was going on in the world in 1999. I mean, I was 12 years old for some perspective. Manu's career spans an incredible swath of American history. I mean, from the days of Michael Jordan to the twilight of LeBron James's career, right? And, you know, he saw so many other dynasties rise and fall, and yet he was there consistently
the entire time, and consistently so too were the Spurs. So that's one of the things we talk about. We talk about how one maintains excellence over the long term. When people sometimes ask me like what I'm trying to build in my career, sometimes I joke like, I want to be the San Antonio Spurs. I don't necessarily obviously you always want to be the best, but it's, you want to be in contention every single year. And sometimes you're the moment and the team and everything aligns and you go all the way, but you always want to be in contention. You always want to be in a position for that to happen. I think consistency is the ultimate accomplishment for an artist, for a business, for an athlete. And obviously that's what I talk about in Perennial Seller as well. The Spurs and Manu are sort of perennially great, or were perennially great in his case. And so it's an honor to talk to Manu. I got to know him. He posted about one of the books on Twitter, which as we talk about in the interview a little bit. We got to know each other. He invited me out for a game. We had lunch or dinner afterwards, I forget. And then have sort of become friends, which is a surreal thing, for me to even be able to say, having, you know, essentially grown up watching him on television and watching him do what he does. And we have a sort of a little book club. We recommend books to each other. We recommend podcasts to each other. And we had an amazing meal together with Coach Raveling, who I had on the podcast a few months back here in Austin. San Antonio is about 70 miles door to door, as R.C. Buford, the GM of the former GM of the Spurs and now the CEO, he likes to point out, it's only 70 miles door to door from San Antonio to Austin. And yet, for whatever reason, the cities feel very far apart. There's not a lot of overlap. They're not only close to each other, but there's an amazing city right in between, San Marcos, which is where the Texas State University is. And there's this river I like to swim in there. Anyways, this is my interview with Manu Ginobili. We talk about basketball. We talk about stoicism. We talk about drive and ambition. Most importantly, we open with a quick conversation on chickens, because he's raising chickens with his kids as part of the quarantine. This is their first go around with some farm animals. And he texted me this morning, proof that after many weeks and months of waiting, they got the chickens as chicks. They got their first egg. So I'm sure the payoff was finally satisfying. I don't want to brag, but we had 7 fresh eggs this morning. So in that one aspect, I guess I come out ahead. But in everything else, the great Manu Ginobili is a inspiration to me. And I think you will really like this conversation. So we'll get right to it. So how was your ride?
Very good. A little uncomfortable towards the end. I'm more of a short distance rider than a long one. So I was a little sore towards the end, but it was fun.
I'm so American that when you sent it to me and I saw it was 30 kilometers, I couldn't even conceive of how long that is.
I understand. I had to change it. I had it in miles before, but since I share more with my Argentinian friends, I move it to kilometers. And then when I share with somebody American, I know there's not even a notion. So 36 kilometers might be 22 miles. Somewhere.
That's not bad. Not bad at all. And my other check-in question for you is, how are the chickens doing?
The chickens, actually, I'm pretty disappointed that either a fox, a raccoon, a neighbor cat slaughtered a couple in the last few days. The kids were very hurt. Me too, because we have had them for 4 months, and before they could lay an egg, 2 were killed. But we have 5 more and more coming on the way. So it's a fun activity.
So still no eggs?
Still no eggs. I'm expecting any day. 4 or 5 months, they say, and I'm at 4, so almost there.
And did you start with pullets? Is that why?
I started with what?
Not actual chicks, but a little bit bigger. They call them pullets. Did you start with pullets? Like,
no.
How little were they when you got them?
You are an expert farmer. I'm not at that level yet. But no, I started with a 3-day chick. It was a gift for my little one, 3 little chicks that were 2-3 days old, and we started from there. That's why it's taking forever.
Right. Yeah, I bet next time you'll go with full-grown chickens. It's just, it takes too long, and it's so boring, and you want the eggs.
For sure.
It's, I do feel like it's kind of,
I think getting chickens was the first animal that we got, or we might have got goats first. I don't remember. But there is kind of a lesson in owning the chickens, which you know rudely experienced this week, which is that life is very brutal and violent and unmerciful. And you kind of are very insulated from that until you get chickens, and then you come out and a possum has ripped one of their heads off, or, you know, they've killed each other. You know, that's one of the weird parts about owning livestock or farmed animals, is just how much death there is.
It's crazy. Yeah. The first time we had an incident with one of the doors of the coop, and one of the doors just fell on top of the head of one. And when we went to feed them and my kids saw that, their faces, oh my, it was a tough one. And then this happened, and yeah, it's a tough learning process, but you know, it's the way life goes, and they are learning, and they are taking care of them. I think it's a good family experience. I mean, I would love to go all in on a farm and get the full experience, but you know, we live in the city, so having five chickens is the most we can do at now, at this point.
Yeah, the weird part about it is, like, I remember we had these geese, and we had one of we really loved one of the gooses, one of the geese, or the goose, or whatever, and it disappeared. Something took it. It didn't come back that night, or whatever. We were really sad about it, and then we noticed that the other four geese did not care at all. And it's sort of a reminder of how sort of quickly animals can process loss and grief and death, and even, you know, they're scared 1 second and then 2 minutes later they're right back to normal. It's sort of humbling to watch these animals handle something that, you know, it took us like days or weeks to get over. Meanwhile, they were over it in 2 seconds.
Completely different. With the first incident we had, the chicken was there, dead. And the other five were just pecking around. And I mean, it's not that we can read emotion, chickens' emotions, but it didn't feel like anything changed. And life goes on, and they had to keep pecking, and life went on. So yeah, it's cool to experience that.
Yeah. So you and I got connected, obviously, you'd read one of my books, and then we connected on social media, and I feel like we've become friends since then. I'm curious, when did reading start for you as an athlete? Was that something you'd always done, or did that come later in your career?
It came like for a few months, and then I stopped reading early in my career. I kind of used it a lot as a way out of my head, of my basketball head. You know, I was very competitive, very intense, very strict with myself, and I went over and over and over the last play or the last mistake or the last loss or whatever. So I needed something to get out of my head. So reading was something that got me into completely different worlds and stories and learning something. So in the last 10 years, I would think, of my career, I started reading more and getting more into the degenerate in general. So that's when I got into, you know, as a way of self-help and trying to improve how I thought, how I lived life. And you know, one of the books that I got across was, both actually, The Obstacle and Ego is the Enemy. But I thought that ego was the one that affected me the most, because in our game, we all thought that we needed it. We thought that if we didn't have that ego, a completely different of self-confidence. Like we talked about it too. So we thought that ego was completely necessary. And I was starting to feel that change, and I got, you know, by the title, I got hooked at it and reading the stories. And so I really got into it. I started following you, and that's how we connected. But yeah, ego and The Obstacle were the two that got my attention first.
So, maybe I'm such an introvert. I was assuming that it must have been you know, playing overseas and then playing in America, that it must, I would have thought like, oh, he became a reader because he's sort of far from home. There's a language barrier. He's just like turns towards books. But you're saying it's later?
Yeah. I've always been a curious mind. So I want to know about other stuff. And if I, you know, listen to a wine connoisseur and, you know, I get interested. And if I go to a museum and I see a archaeologist, I get interested and I start asking questions. And then maybe I get into reading one of his books. And with different topics, I get excited too. So I'm also curious and I like learning stuff. But the truth is that I, especially after games, reading really helped me. And towards the end, at the beginning it was, you know, more on the computers, video games or movies. But towards the end, really relaxed me and got me to get my head busy into something more productive and calm me down and got me to sleep earlier. So it was a great addition to my career, starting reading more.
Do you mostly read in English? Or I mean, I'm jealous of people who can read in multiple languages.
Yes, I mostly read in English because most of the books I'm reading are in English. If I read a Spanish author, of course, I'll read it in Spanish or, you know, a Spanish-speaking author. So I would say 80 English, 20% Spanish.
I'm curious about you're talking about your intensity and your competitiveness. I guess you're one of the only people I can ask this, but so, you know, I'm obviously fascinated with Jordan. Everyone's watched The Last Dance. And I think one of the lessons people sort of take away from that is like, oh, you have to be like a killer. You know, you can't ever let up. You have to have this sort of intensity, this desire to win at all costs. And one of the interesting things for me, obviously getting to know some athletes, is, you know, sometimes when I hear people say that, I go, you know, Manu has 4 rings. He doesn't seem like he'd rip your throat out. Do you feel like you have that? Or do you feel like maybe that's a misperception about sports?
I think there are different levels of competitiveness. And I think MJ was just at a different level than everybody else. And the fact that he was so gifted, so good, and so strict with himself kind of made it to push the other ones the same way as he was pushing himself. And it's like when you are so good and you push yourself so hard, it's like you kind of demand it on the rest, saying, I'm doing all this, how can you not? And it's hard to have empathy that, you know, some other players have a different mindset and they just play because they like it. And it's not all about winning or winning at all costs. So yeah, watching the documentary was super fun to see how I relate to something. Some others I said, no, not even close. But me being a huge, huge fan of MJ in those times, it was super exciting to watch it and witness it. Of course, I can't even compare to Jordan in any levels. I did win 4 championships, but, you know, our best player was Tim, and Tim was the one pushing us, and we were just helping, and we were trying to be as good as we can. But yeah, I agree that there are other ways to lead, to win, and get the best out of people without making it hell. So I think the way that Jordan behaved or acted, it was the only way you could when you are Michael Jordan. I guess like guys like him or Kobe, they are just at a different level mentally and skill level. So it's hard to put yourself in their bodies or their heads when they are so different, right, than the rest.
Yeah, no, you make a good point, which is that the competitiveness and the drive and the ferocity of it almost doesn't work unless it's coupled with extreme talent. I was just reading this fascinating book called The Wise Men, which is about sort of U.S. foreign policy over the, you know, basically from World War I to Vietnam. And it was talking about the Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, and who is this sort of brilliant but kind of acerbic, you know, quick-witted guy. And they were saying that that a lot of his virtues were imitated by less talented people, and that was not so good. So I think, you know, it's sort of like people read about Steve Jobs and they go, oh, to be a CEO, you have to be an asshole. That's probably the wrong lesson to take from Michael Jordan. You should take, no, you have to be really good and you have to love the game. You know, it's like, it's almost like we look for the part of it that excuses the worst parts of our personality instead of focusing on the parts that would actually challenge us.
If you're not as good as him and you behave as him, you'll be gone in a blink of an eye. The team, the organization would not allow it unless you are that special, and with the way you compete and what you provide to the team makes it worth it. So you really gotta be that special to be that intense, because as you can tell by watching the documentary, it wasn't enjoyable at many moments. I mean, for many of the guys, it was tough to have to withstand all that intensity and accountability. And so, no, you really gotta be a Jordan, a Bryant, a James, or a special guy like that, or a Steve Jobs, of course.
Sure.
Gates or somebody like that you can see that they are different, that they are visionaries or unique to make it worth it.
I mean, you've played with so many of the greatest of all time, whether it's Tim Duncan, you've played with Steve Kerr, you've played with Robert Horry. I mean, obviously you've played for Popovich. So you've really been around a collection of the people who have won the most in really the history of the game. What do you, when you look at those people up close, like, so the Stoics obviously are fascinated with, you know, an Alexander the Great or the sort of conquerors of history. And they were so curious about whether you could be happy and be sort of ceaselessly driven in that sense, or whether it was possible to be great at that level and kind of not be broken in some way. I'm curious about obviously your own experience being one of the greats of all time and having, you know, accumulated basically more championships than 99.9% of people who've ever played a basketball, but then also having to seeing up close and personal the other people in that league. Like, what's your sense of getting to the top of that mountain?
It's very tough because we are driven by the challenge, right? And to have that challenge, you have to have that type of uncertainty, unsatisfaction. Sorry, you know, we are humans, and humans didn't evolve to just be happy and chill and be satisfied with their lives. And they are, you know, it's about, you know, drive and necessity and goals. And I think our competitiveness, and you mentioned most of them, like, you know, Bob, Tim, Steve, Robert, whatever, David Robinson, is like they became so good because of constant drive, but also, like, you know, competing with other people. And I don't think that we were very stoic behaving. I mean, if you see Pop acting after a loss or after a win, you would tell very quickly that it was not very stoic of him, the way he competed. But, you know, with time, you start improving and maturing, and then you start learning and that there are ways of maintaining some competitiveness and desire, and at the same time being happy and enjoying the ride that we always talk about. So I would say that I played 23 years professionally, 18. I was so driven and so goal-oriented that unless I won the last of the games, I wasn't happy with myself. And I was remorseful and thinking about the mistakes I made and how I could have been better or how I could have made my teammates better. And then, you know, when you get older and you start seeing the end of your career, you start enjoying other things, and wins or losses are not that such a dramatic change, and you become a father, and that gets a part of it too. So I think I was way, way better and way happier my last 3 years when I started to act more like that, right? Like, you know, win or lose, okay, I gave my best, I gave everything I had, and I tried to provide my teammates with all the tools, and but it just was not enough. It's okay, I'll shake my opponent's hand, I keep going the same way. But I think that a common denominator in most of the highly competitive and successful athletes, stoicism is not something that is ingrained.
Right.
And I think it's necessary. I always said when we talked, or even on Twitter, I said a couple of times, I think it's necessary to read about that stillness. Your last book was, it gives a few awesome hints just to how to improve the quality of your life during this craziness of an athletic career.
No, I think it's true in writing too. I mean, I think it hit me probably on stillness, but maybe the book before, but I was just sort of like, why am I not having any fun doing this? And if I'm not having fun, then the only reason I'm doing it is to get the thing on the other side, which is the success or having it or the critical reception, which is a very unstoic thing, because now you've said that somebody else gets to choose or has power over whether the year and a half of your life that you spent on something was worth it. And that just struck me as totally nuts.
Great. Yeah, I agree. In my case, it was just that somebody else was better than me. So how is that? That I'm going to enjoy a summer just because somebody else was better than me, or I, you know, made a mistake, or a teammate made a mistake, or a ref, or whatever. It made no sense. But also, as I said before, I started to understand it too late in my career. But it makes no sense when something that you can't really control affects your current state. I mean, it makes no sense. So it helped me to read it, because you start maturing and you start to understand it. But once you see it written, and that, you know, it's been on people's minds for thousands of years, I said, yeah, of course. I mean, I live it this way. I'm an NBA player at that time. Well, somebody else was an author, as you said. Some mother was an emperor, and they went through the same thing. So it's amazing. It was very useful for me.
I remember I was at a Spurs game last season, and the Spurs were down by a ton. And so they were kind of listless and boring and not playing as they should. And I remember, I think RC pointed out that this was going to happen. But anyways, Pop threw basically a temper tantrum, got himself ejected from the game. And then Tim Duncan took over as coach. It was incredible to watch Tim Duncan coach a Spurs game. But I watched this happen, and the craziest thing about it is, like, you might go, oh, you know, that's, you know, the Stoics would say that's a bad use of your emotions. You're not in control of yourself. But it was actually, from what I was told, a very sort of deliberate strategy. He was trying to wake the team up, get them excited. And the Spurs ended up losing, but only by one point. And they'd come back and rallied after this had happened. And so I'm very fascinated with these sort of calculated bursts of emotion, which, you know, again, would on its face be not stoic, but if you're doing it deliberately, maybe it is.
Yes, there were many of those. There are other times when you can tell that they are totally honest. They are the real thing, the real emotion. Some others is calculated. And it happens also in a video session in which you could see, in this case, Pop, of course, going ballistic on people and getting frustrated. And sometimes you could also see that he's premeditated, that he was looking for a way to push some of the players to avoid complacency, to avoid that sense of satisfaction when you are winning five in a row. So there's a bit of both, but a little more stoicism in all of us wouldn't really hurt.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
No, I agree. You were telling me something, because obviously I'm a lifelong Kings fan, and you were telling me that when you were coming into the league, you were looking at certain players that maybe sort of didn't fit in one specific role that you would sort of build your style around. You were saying Doug Christie was one of those players, which is obviously sort of music to my ears. How did you, you were at that time, not many players had come from South America. So were you sort of consciously looking for mentors that would help you make that transition? Is that what was happening?
I was having a quick developing, right? I mean, not quick in the sense that I got to the NBA at 25, but a lot of things happened before the last 2 years of my career in Europe, and I saw a lot of things happening. So when I got to the NBA, of course, I had uncertainties. I wasn't sure if I belonged, if I was going to fit in the system of the Spurs, if I was going to have a long career, or it was just going to be a three-year thing and I was going to go back to Europe. So I didn't know. And I started to look at players, and I started to try to learn what other players did, because I was not comparing myself to Kobe at that time or at Ray Allen. I didn't think I had that type of scorer in me. I thought I was more of an all-around type of player. And, the Kings were really good at that time. And I remember playing against the Kings, and of course, saw Stojakovic and Bibi making so many shots, or Divac, or whatever. But Christie, I thought, was the glue that made that team a great team too. And he was, getting steals and great passes and rebounds and charges. So I saw a little bit of myself in Christie early in my career, and I was looking at him. Then it turned out that I developed my scoring ability, and I was able to add other things. And but I remember vividly that one of the first games against the Kings, I was surprised, because it was not somebody that was on everybody's radar. Who mentioned Christie when we're watching at the Kings? But I remember playing against him and seeing what he could do on the court, and I was very impressed.
Yeah, he had this reverse dunk he would do sometimes, and nobody does that, right? Like, and he had this. He was sort of always more than you expected, which I guess is a sort of the ultimate compliment in one sense, that he was sort of always punching above his weight, whether it was defensively or explosively, like on a fast break or something.
Yeah, he understood the game. He knew where to be. Sometimes you may think, oh, he was in the right spot. Yeah, but he knew how to get to the right spot. So is another type of talent that is a little harder to notice. You know, you see Stojakovic making 8 threes, and that's pretty easy to notice, or Zweb doing what he did. But seeing Doug, you know, get in position and get steals and go for helps that maybe was not like expected, but he saw something because that instinct he really had. So it was fun to watch.
No, to me, that's like career advice that doesn't get sort of put out there enough. So people go, okay, you know, in your game, and be like, this is what LeBron James is doing. This is what Damian Lillard is doing. So I should do that. But then they also go, oh, like, this is the hot startup right now. So I'm going to make a startup in this space. Or, you know, people go, these kind of books are successful right now. I'm going to make books like that. And what they don't realize is that they are going head to head with the best person in the world at that thing. So I like the idea that you were like, I'm not going to model myself off Kobe because Kobe is a once in a generational talent. I'm going to find something. Essentially what you're doing, which is also what you do in basketball, you go where there's the least amount of defense or where there's the least amount of resistance or difficulty. You're always looking for open court. And I think people don't do that enough in life. They kind of copy other people and they want to go head to head against something that's really tough. When really they're missing, they had a little bit more humility, they'd actually have found a better, less contested opportunity.
Yeah, maybe. I also think that very important point is that you got to know who you are, what you got, what you can provide. If you are going to force yourself into being somebody else that is being successful, it's not going to work. So with what you have, with what you are, well, try to find your niche. Try to find the best area to exploit. So in my case, it was that. I didn't think I was going to be a big scorer in the NBA. I thought I was a good enough passer. I thought I could be a good enough defender, or I have good instincts with steals or charges. So that's where I saw myself, who I saw myself modeling after. Then things went different ways, but I assume and I guess that in many areas is the same.
And you played 23 seasons, probably would have been more if you'd come through the typical, you know, American structure, because you would have entered the league earlier. But what's fascinating about so you have this incredible longevity, which I'm fascinated with from a sort of biomechanical standpoint and like sort of how that's physically possible. But it's also you are a member of perhaps the oldest dynasty or the longest dynasty professional basketball, maybe professional sports. I mean, I think what the Spurs have made the playoffs like 23 consecutive seasons, maybe 22. I feel like that's another thing that people think about, like, how do I get successful right now? How do I win right now? But we seem to spend less time thinking about sustainability of whatever we're trying to do.
Man, what happened here is so unusual. You saw it a little. I don't know much about other sports in America, but you saw it briefly in Utah, I guess, with Sloan, Malone, and Stockton. But you don't see it that often, especially in the basketball now, to have a same coach, same core group of players for so long. It is very, very unusual. So, you know, of course, we got a little lucky, but and there was a match from the beginning between Pop and Tim, and RC, of course, too, is part of all this, that get everything else easier. Everybody that came to this organization after that, and after David Robinson, of course, too, it was easier to fit, or because you could see how the franchise players behaved and how the coach acted and how accountable he held everybody. So everybody that came just fit, and nobody tried to be above the system. So having this type of success for so long is very unusual. So very lucky to have been part of all this.
How did in your personal part in that, just staying healthy, you know, staying competitive for as long, like what is the, how do you not, I guess, how does an organization, but then also how did you as an individual not burn out? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's what obviously looks sort of what happened with Tom Brady and Bill Belichick is like at a certain point they were like, I just want a break.
Mm-hmm. I guess it was also Pat's touch, right? To be able to keep everybody together and keep everybody excited and happy. Individually, also luck is a big part because I never had a big injury. I never had a big issue. And I was always, you know, very easy. I never partied a lot. I never drank. I never did drugs. And I loved the game. I wanted to be the best player I could. And I've been married forever. And so I had a life at home. So I had it easy in that sense. Then when I started to see things getting uphill with injuries, and I started to fine tune everything, right? Food and sleep. And I hired my own physio to come home and help me every day, or you know, he was coming from Spain, so help me a week every month. And you know, I started to be more cautious and more careful with everything I did, because I knew it was going to affect how I was going to compete, not only that weekend, that week, but you know, long term. At 35, 36, 37, you know, you see young guys coming to the league that are stronger, faster, they jump higher, they shoot better from farther, and you say, how am I going to compete with all this? So, you know, with your experience and adaptation and knowing the system, you and staying healthy, I was able to manage and figure it out.
I imagine just sort of sheer grit has got to be a part of that too, organizationally and individually. There must have been times where you were like, I don't want to do this anymore, but you pushed through that.
Of course. And especially we were held accountable and every game counted. I mean, I don't think anybody in the whole NBA had we didn't get a break in one game. Having Pop and and being part of an organization that had a chance to win, like it was intense all the time. So for moments it was tough, and we were, you know, in dinners with Tony and Tim, like saying, "Oh, here we go again." Like it's tough, but you know, we push each other, and there were moments where Pop saw that he was pushing too much, so he just gave us a little leash. But overall, we all felt like we belonged, like we were part of something greater than ourselves, and that's why we pushed it, and we wanted to stay and try to win with our teammates in this organization. So it was a little compromise from everybody too.
Yeah, and it was like 20 seasons in before the concept of load management became a thing. So you missed all of that.
Well, actually, Pop was maybe the first one to implement it. And it all started with a game in Miami that we played in Orlando. And just Pop, out of nowhere, said, "No, you guys are not playing. Fly back home." And he got fined because it was a televised game. It was a high-profile game. And he started to sit us on back-to-backs. That's another thing that helped me play till 40, right? Because if you look at my minutes, average in minutes, all my career, I think I had only one season in which I played more than 30 minutes. So I was always... being a backup, I was in load management all my career, so that also helped me. My last 5 years, I think, maybe, yeah, I barely played any back-to-backs. So yeah, pub was a precursor, you call it, like one of the first ones to, to do it.
My last question for you is obviously what a lot of people are talking about right now, the sort of the activism that we're seeing in the NBA, obviously there in the bubble. I said something about it and someone responded, you know, like, these guys are getting paid millions of dollars. Like, how could they not play? And I, which struck me as so insane, because it's like the whole point of being successful and good at what you do, and this being a free country, is that if you don't want to work, you don't have to work. No one can force you to work. And if you feel like not working or using your platform would allow you to make a statement or apply pressure somewhere where it needs to be, I feel like it's honorable to do it.
Right, and it's unbelievable what's happening. I mean, so proud of what the NBA is doing, of what the players are doing, using that huge platform to talk about what they believe in. And yeah, there's always going to be people that hate or that disagree. One because they are rich, the other one's because they are poor, they're because they're white or black, whatever. I mean, if they're wealthy and they speak, it's even more merit. Because they did it good and they are sacrificing themselves and they are willing to pay the consequences. It's amazing what is happening. And I do feel, even I've been out for 2 years now, but you could tell by how they act, how they talk. And, you know, after what happened in Kenosha a few days ago, how they all stopped, they are committed. And they are in it together because they have an organization that is backing them up. And now there's also franchises, whole franchises that are backing them up. So I think it's a great opportunity for change. I mean, I'm so happy that it's going well. I had my doubts about the bubble with this pandemic and how they were going to be able to keep it like that. And it's working great. I'm very proud. I wish I could be there helping in some way, but it's really amazing what they're doing. So haters, always going to be there. You can satisfy 100% of, you know, the people. And with social media, you know, even if 10 start complaining and saying that they hate it and millions say there is great, you know, they have a loud voice and they make themselves, they found some way to hurt feelings and all that. But I think it's amazing what we are seeing, and I'm happy to have been part of that.
Yeah, people seem to, it's weird, even in the Stoic community, this idea of justice being a virtue. I think people think that that's just this kind of vague idea that doesn't actually obligate you to do anything, or that it's somebody else's problem. And what I think is so impressive about it is, yeah, not only did the Bucks say, hey, we're willing to forfeit a game here, and when they made the decision, they had no idea, you know, what would happen. And what I thought was so impressive was that the Magic were like, no, like, we're not going to allow you to, you know, like, we want in on this too. I think what's so impressive, and I think it's a good metaphor or a good learning example for people, is that here you have all these people who are ostensibly rivals, who are, you know, under ordinary circumstances would do just about anything to get an edge over each other. You know, they're all competing for a finite amount of contracts and dollars and championships. And yet they're able to sort of put that aside and go, like, here's where the line is. And the line is, you know, shooting people in the back, or the line is, you know, like, violations of, you know, sort of basic human decency. And we're all going to come together about that.
It's really awesome. It's beautiful. I agree. Even like when I was younger, I consider everybody else opponents, rivals in some way. And the game is changing and guys are realizing that, we try to win a game, but we are all in this together, and we have an amazing opportunity to bring justice, to get people to know what's going on, to open their eyes, and that, you know, shut up and dribble, that's BS, man. This is a way, a great way to get everybody to know what's going on, and they are doing it fantastically because, you know, as you all know, everybody knows, the NBA is not an American league. It's a worldwide league. It's the most followed league in the world. And when things like this happen, maybe it sparks something in another country, or maybe no, probably. And other guys are going to see what's going on. So I think that they are really leading the way, both organization, like the NBA, and players especially, stepping up. So again, I gotta say it again, I'm super proud of what's going on.
No, and I think it's realizing that individuals when they come together have the ability to shape change or drive the agenda or have leverage. Like I watched a video of Nick Saban leading a march of Alabama players, you know, for social justice yesterday. And, you know, it's not that he wasn't doing it voluntarily, but like that is a result of the pressure that athletes and college athletes are, you know, have the least amount of leverage or power than probably any athlete in any sport. That's the result of these athletes sort of realizing that, you know, if they're smart and if they're coordinated and if they're clear about what their aims and demands are, that you can exert influence and pressure, which is the whole point of the system that we have here, is that individuals have to do that.
For sure. We athletes, or former athletes, are a few of the people that are like outside of the bubbles that we, you know, you talk to Republicans and they get together with Republicans and they watch Republican media outlets. You talk with Democrats and they the same on the other side. Everybody watches basketball. Everybody watches football and baseball. I think we have an amazing tool to reach to everybody. And the guys are using it. Even arenas are going to become voting venues now. And I think that's going to reach to a lot of people, kids that are outside of the system that just, you know, they want to be a basketball player, but now they are listening to the basketball player and they follow them on Instagram, on Twitter, or TikTok, or whatever. So, again, they are using it. They're doing it great. They're being great examples, great leaders, and I'm proud of it.
I love it. Thanks so much. It was it's awesome to talk again, and appreciate all the kind words about the books. And we'll have to go for a bike ride one of these days.
I'm in. We'll meet halfway. I don't know what's halfway between
San Marcos.
In San Marcos. All right.
Perfect. All right, man. Talk soon.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. See you.
If you're liking this podcast, we would love for you to subscribe. Please leave us a review on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast listening apps. It really helps. And tell a friend.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.